Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. I'm Rachel Isaacs, the engineer for this program. We look forward to learning some Torah with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Today we are joined by Rabbi Meir Schweiger, a faculty member in the Mashgiach Ruchani at Pardes. He will be teaching us about Parshat Shelach. A few quick announcements, and then we'll hand it over to Rabbi Schweiger. Your participation and feedback is vital for the success of the podcast series. Please send us comments on the episode, where you live, and how you heard about us. Send your email to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thank you. That's it. And now Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Rachel. This week's Parsha, Parshat Shlach, discusses the story of the spies. This is the main topic of this week's parsha. The story of the spies comes up in two places, when it actually happened, which is our parsha, and later on in the book of Dvarim, Deuteronomy, in chapter 1, Moshe recalls the story. There are a number of differences between the way the story is presented. I will not go into the comparison between those two versions. What I'd like to do is to focus on the way the story is presented by us and a number of issues that are raised. And the first thing which I would like to talk about is there's a discussion as to whether sending the spies all together is a good idea. Should the Jews have sent the spies? And there's a very, very long discussion in the Ramban, Nachmanides, regarding this issue. And I just want to present the two sides to the coin. One side of the coin is that if the Jewish people are right now on the threshold of entering the land of Israel, and in order to be able to take possession of the land of Israel, they will have to wage war, then it makes sense for them to do whatever is humanly possible to prepare for that encounter. Or, in the language of the Ramban, Ein somchin al hanes, you don't rely on a miracle. And therefore, if the Jewish people are about to engage in warfare, then they have to collect intelligence, they have to do everything which they need in preparation of their endeavors. An alternative view, which seems to be very much the midrashic way of looking at it, is that in fact the people were not necessarily going to engage in warfare, that God was going to do that for them, and this connects with something which we discussed last week, and as a result of that, there's no need to have to then make all of these human preparations, since God is going to be the one who's going to do the interference for them. In our parsha, it's actually very interesting that the directive to send the spies actually comes from God. And therefore, it would be somewhat problematic to say that God is now setting the people up for the kill, so to speak, that God is presenting what we would call an obstacle to the people. And I would like to now, perhaps, begin with what seems to be the approach of the Ramban as to what is the purpose of God sending the spies. If we look at chapter 13, verse 2, it says, Shlach lecha anashim, send people, v'yaturu et eretz Kanaan, and let them spy out the land of Kanaan, asher ani noten levnei Yisrael, that I'm giving to the Jewish people, ish echad, one man, lemateh avotav tishlachu, per tribe you should send, kol nasivahem. All of them are princes in their tribes. And Nachmanides raises a very interesting question. If what we're interested in is spies who will actually check out the land and be able to bring back all of the information which is necessary, intelligence, for the military operation, it seems to be that this is not the way to go about doing it. And what do I mean by that? If what you're interested in is an intelligence operation, number one, you try to minimize the number of people that you send. And in fact, we find a parallel story in the beginning of the book of Joshua in chapter 2, where Joshua also sends out spies before the Jewish people enter the land, except that in Joshua, he sends out 2 spies. Here, we're sending out 12 spies. And it makes sense that when you're interested in gathering intelligence, you want to minimize the number of people who are doing this so that you maintain the secrecy of the mission. In Joshua, it speaks about how the spies are sent out secretly. The sense which you get from our section is that this is a public endeavor. This is not done secretly. Furthermore, the people who are being sent in our section are described as being princes. It doesn't make sense to send out princes to gather intelligence. And to perhaps use the language of the Ramban, you would like to send out people who are quote-unquote more dispensable. So then what is the purpose of the spies here? And the Ramban introduces a very interesting concept. The purpose of the spies is to be a representative body of the people who are in a very symbolic way taking possession of the land before the actual people of Israel come in. And Nachmanides connects this with a concept in Jewish law, which is chazakah, where one physically takes possession of property. Very often, what a mode of acquisition is that you simply walk the length and breadth of the property, and that way somehow demonstrate that you are the new owner. And therefore, Nachmanides says that the purpose of sending the spies is not primarily to gather intelligence, but rather to be a group who are the leadership of the people, the princes of the people, who represent all the tribes, and in that capacity are now symbolically taking possession of the land of Israel. It's very interesting when we look further on at the questions which Moshe presents to them that they're supposed to investigate. Some of the questions clearly have military aspects to them. And if we look at verse 18, where it says, go and check out the land, check out the people who are dwelling there. Are they strong? Are they weak? Are they few? Are they many? Even subsequently in chapter 19, when he says, look at the cities. Are they fortified cities? Are they open cities? But Moshe also asks them, what about the land in verse 19? Is the land good? Is the land bad? In verse 20, is the land fat? Is it lean? Are there trees? Now, of course, one could say that this can also be translated into military intelligence. And in fact, the Ramban actually brings this up, that there may be what we call a certain psychological dimension, which is that if, and it would seem to be that this is perhaps the thinking of Moshe, that the land really is a land which is fat, and the land really is a land which is good, that if the spies come back and speak about the glory of the land, then that can actually become an incentive to the people to go and conquer it. Yet nevertheless, the Ramban seems to adopt the position that the purpose of seeking out what type of land this is, in the language of the Ramban, is like a merchant who's about to purchase something, and before he purchases it, he wants to check it out completely to make sure that this is what he really wants to buy. And by the same token, this is a delegation which is going to thoroughly inspect the land before they finally now come and take possession of it. What I would like to now do is investigate what is the report which the spies bring back and what makes it so problematic. So let's skip to verse 26. When the spies come back, and it says in the verse 25, they return after spying out the land at the end of a period of 40 days. In verse 26 it says, Vayelchu vayavo el Moshe v'el Aharon, they go and they come to Moshe and Aaron, v'el kol adat b'nei Yisrael, and to all of the Jewish people, el midbar Paran, to the desert of Paran, Kadesha, vayashivu otam davar, and they return to them the matter, v'et kol hayda, and all the congregation, vayarum et pri ha'aretz, and they show them the fruits of the land. The first thing which is interesting to note is that the spies do not go back and report to Moshe, who was the one who sent them. But it seems to be that the spies actually get together all of the Jewish population so that when they report to Moshe, it's done in the presence of the whole congregation. And again, I'd like to say this is in contrast to what we find later on with Joshua, that the spies report back directly to Joshua, who then processes their information and then leads the Jewish people. Even if the spies are much more than just an intelligence gathering group, the most logical thing would have been for the spies to report back directly to Moshe and then to have Moshe, quote unquote, organize the press conference, which then brings the information to the people at large. So that it's very, very striking that Moshe is now being informed at the same time as everybody else. And now what do the spies say? When we look at verse 27, it says, Vayisapru lo vayomru, and they tell him, and they say, Banu el ha'aretz asher shlachtanu, we have come to the land which you have sent us. V'gam zavat chalav udvashi, v'zeh pirya, and is also flowing with milk and honey, and behold, this is its fruit. Efes, which I'll translate for the moment as, but, ki az ha'am, the people are tenacious, hayoshev ba'aretz, who dwell in the land. V'ha'arim b'tzurot gedolot ma'od, and the cities are very fortified. V'gam yilidei ha'anak ra'inu sham, and also children of the giants we have seen there. Amalek yoshev ba'aretz ha'negev, Amalek is settled in the land of the Negev. Hachiti, Ayivusi, Hamori, Yoshe, Bahar, all these different groups are settled in the mountain. Haknani, Yoshe, Val Hayam, the Canaanites are by the sea. Va'al Yad HaYarden, and by the Jordan. On the one hand, when we look at what the spies are saying, at face value, it seems to be perfectly legitimate. They are answering all the questions which Moshe posed. Are the people strong? The answer is, they're tenacious. Are the people few or many? Well, it would seem to be, from the description, that there are many groups over here. So that they're many, they're not few. What about the cities? Are the cities fortified? Yes, the cities are very heavily fortified. What about the land? Well, they say, yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey. And they show the fruit. So that the spies have answered every question which Moshe posed. So is there anything problematic about what they say over here? I'd like to point out two things that seem to be problematic. The first thing, and this is something which the Ramban points out, is when the spies say the land is flowing with milk and honey, and then in the beginning of verse 28, say the word Ephes. The word Ephes is a problem. I translated the word Ephes as but, which is the way the Ramban translates it. And therefore, if you then look at what the spies do over here, they say, the land is flowing with milk and honey, but... And then they go on to describe what all the peoples are like. And therefore, there's a very interesting intermingling over here of what we would call fact and analysis. And what do I mean by that? What the spies are doing are not just reporting the facts, but it may very well be that they're also giving their analysis of it. It's not just answering each of the questions which Moshe posed, but what it's doing is also giving their evaluation. And what do I mean? They say, yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey, but the people are tenacious. The people are numerous. Everywhere that you look, there's another group of people who will have to go and fight. And therefore, by using the word but, it's a way of saying, the land is flowing with milk and honey, but it's impossible to conquer it. It's setting up the stakes for the futility of entering into the land. The spies were not asked to give their analysis. They were asked to bring back the facts. By using the word but, it's very problematic. I just want to add, in modern Hebrew, the word ephes means zero. And if you were to interject that in this context, it would be saying, yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey, but it's worthless. How can we possibly get any value from that when it's impossible to conquer it? And let me add a third thing, which I think is very striking in this context. It's very interesting that when we tell the story on the Seder night, in the Mishnah in Masechet Psachim, the rabbis tell us how we're supposed to tell the story. The way we're supposed to tell it is matchil bignut u'mesayim b'shvach. We start telling the bad part, we conclude with the good part. Which means, we start by saying, our ancestors were enslaved in Egypt. But the end of the story is how we were taken out. And the reasoning behind this manner of telling the story is because, again, it contextualizes the story. If you discuss how horrible it was in Egypt, but it had a happy ending, the ending is what sticks in your mind. So that despite all of the misery which the Jews had, but in the end, we left. And by the same token, if they would have reversed the order in our story and said, yes, there are numerous people there and they're tenacious and they're ferocious and they're giants, but the land is great. It would have completely changed the whole thrust of the report. It would have then ended on a high. And it would have given the people this vision of what they need to be fighting for. And therefore, what I want to bring out with this analysis is that although the spies could have very easily said, "We're answering your questions, Moshe. We're simply doing our job," it's clear that there's much more at stake over here. This is not just reporting the facts, but by reporting the facts in the way that they do, they're also making a value judgment. No way that we can enter the land of Israel. And not only that, but it makes it even more frustrating when they say the land is flowing with milk and honey, and then they show them the fruits, and it's as if they're dangling the fruits in front of their eyes, and then getting them all excited. Look at what we found in the land. But you know what? Ephes. It's absolutely worthless. No way that you're going to go and conquer it. So that it just, by highlighting how wonderful the land is, it just totally destroys, demoralizes the people by then ending on how impossible it is to conquer the land. As a parenthetical note, I would say this is a very interesting issue in terms of media nowadays. Where do you draw the line between the facts and the analysis? And I think very often the lines are blurred. And I think good journalism, good reporting, would require that people should be extremely careful to report the facts and then make it very, very clear, okay, when they're giving you the analysis. And this can very often be done nowadays in a very subtle way. What do you report first? How much time do you give it? To what degree is it that you give maybe 10 minutes to one side of the question, 1 minute to the other side of the question? There are many, many subtle ways in which things are reported, which in the end are not just reporting the facts, but could very well be slanting it in a certain, towards a certain goal. And that's why the rabbis see that what's happening here with the spies is a classic example of lashon hara, of slandering, of where the rabbis clear, of where the spies clearly have an agenda. Their agenda is that they don't want the Jewish people to go into the land. And now let's see how the story develops, or maybe I should say how it snowballs. When we look at verse 30, all of a sudden we have Kalev, who gets up and silences the people. And Kalev says, "Alon na'alev yarashnu ota ki yachol nuchala." We can go up. And he says the word "Alon na'alev," he doubles it as a way of saying, we can surely go up. And we will take possession of it. And the second time he says, "Ki yachol nuchal," doubling the verb. We can surely overcome. We can surely triumph. And from the context, it's very clear that when the spies gave their report, that there must have been grumbling among the people, or even more than grumbling, perhaps an uproar. And therefore it says Kalev has to somehow silence the people. And it's very interesting that what Kalev does is to try to speak in very emphatic terms to counter what the spies did. Because the impression which the spies leave is, it's totally impossible to conquer this land. And Kalev goes to the other extreme and says, we shall surely go up. We shall surely overcome. And now the people are presented with a dilemma. There are spies, and the bulk of the spies, who seem to be saying in their subtle way, no way that we can take possession of the land. And then I have another voice, the voice of Kalev, who says, on the contrary, we can surely do it. Note also that Kalev doesn't speak about God in this verse. In this verse, he says, we can do it. And now let's look at verse 31. It says, V'hanashim asher imo amru, and the people who went up with him say, Lo nuchal, we cannot go up. to this people. Ki chazaku mimenu, because they are stronger than us. And so what do I see? I see now a debate which is going on. Kalev presented the counter, and then the initial group of spies come up and say, we cannot do it. They are stronger. But they don't suffice with that. And now let's look at verse 32. Vayotziu dibat ha'aretz, and now they slander the land, asher taru ota, which they had spied out, el b'nei Yisrael emor, to the children of Israel, saying, ha'aretz asher avarnu va'laturota, the land which we passed through to spy out, eretz ochelet yoshvahi, it's a land which eats up its inhabitants, v'chol ha'am asher ra'inu b'tochan shemidot, and all the men we saw in its midst are men of stature. V'sham ra'inu atanafilim, and there we saw the giants, b'nei anak minafilim, highlighting this idea of giants. V'anihi ve'einenu kachagavim, and we were in our eyes as grasshoppers. V'chein hayinu be'einehem, and so we were in their eyes. The Ramban points out on verse 32, that whenever the Torah uses the word lohotzi diba, which means to slander, lohotzi diba as opposed to lahavi diba, in one case to take out diba, in the other case to bring in, lohotzi means not only to slander, but to lie. Lahavi diba means to slander, but to speak truth. And then it becomes very interesting. When the majority of the spies see that the people are wavering, that the people are not absolutely convinced by their argument, but are also giving an attendant ear to Kalev, their recourse is to have to fabricate information which they feel in the end is going to tip the scales. And there are two parts to that information. The first thing, Eretz ochelet yoshvahi, it's a land that eats up its inhabitants, which is in sharp contrast to what they said in the very beginning when they said, this is a land flowing with milk and honey. And in fact, Nachmanides, the Ramban, gives a very interesting take on this. When the spies showed the people the fruit are huge. They're unbelievable, which is indicative of the fact that it's a land flowing with milk and honey. Look at what unbelievable fruit you grow. And now what they're doing is taking that and inverting it on its head as a way of saying, yes, the fruits are huge. But what that shows you is that the land itself is a place which is not for normal people. It doesn't have normal fruit. The fruits are exceptionally large. And therefore, this is a land which will eat up its inhabitants, regular people. Survival of the fittest. The only ones who can survive there are giants. And then what they do is they play up this idea of how only giants are here. Now, it's interesting that when the story happened, in verse 22, it says that they come to Hebron and there are giants there. But it seems to be from the verses that it's only in Hebron that there may be some giants. Now, all of a sudden, that becomes extended to the whole country, where everybody are giants. Everybody are men of stature. So that the fabrication which the people are doing is to try to now have terror tactics to totally overwhelm the people, intimidate them, as a way of saying, the only way you can survive in this land is to be a giant. Normal people can't survive. So even if, hypothetically, we could conquer these people, which clearly is an impossibility, but we would eventually die because the climactic conditions would do us in. And I'd like to end with the following note. despite the fact that I agree with Nachmanides, that I think that there is this fabrication here. But perhaps there's one point which is true, which is maybe what is at the core of this slandering report. The very last thing which the spies say is, "We were in our eyes as grasshoppers, and so we were in their eyes." And this perhaps is the core of the problem. There's something which has always disturbed me when I read the story. How is it possible that in the beginning of the story, I have 12 men who are handpicked, who are described as being significant men, who are princes, who come back and give this evil report? And the answer perhaps lies in what they say about themselves. "We were in our eyes as grasshoppers." There's a very interesting question over here. How do you see yourself? And then how do other people look at you? If you see yourself as a grasshopper, as a small person, other people will look at you as a small person. And now let's go to the report. There's no question that there are tenacious people who are living in this land. There are many nations. There are fortified cities. Yes, it will not be easy conquering this land. And if for a moment I leave out of the equation God's role in bringing this about, if I were to just see this as being something which the people themselves have to do, it is certainly a daunting task. But there's always the question of, as they say in some places, separating the men from the boys, or maybe in other places, separating the people of stature from the grasshoppers. The problem of the spies is that they are overwhelmed by the pragmatics. They have somehow lost sight of the vision. Yes, if I were to look numerically, if I were to look in terms of military capabilities, the people who are living in the land represent an unbelievable challenge. But there's the vision that the Jewish people have now been given the opportunity to actualize their destiny. And this is an opportunity which should impel them to now go and overcome all the obstacles in their path. Are you a visionary? Are you a pragmatist? Pragmatists sometimes tend to be overwhelmed by the realities. Visionaries create realities. If I were to draw a very interesting analogy, a similar debate existed with the creation of the modern state of Israel. There were the pragmatists who basically said, "How can you possibly declare a state? The moment the state will be declared, the surrounding Arab nations will declare war. They numerically outnumber you. Not only numerically, but also in terms of the firepower which they have. You will be washed into the sea. There will be a second Holocaust." And to the credit of David Ben-Gurion and his followers, he said, "But this is the moment that the Jewish people have been waiting for 2,000 years. This has been our vision. This has been our destiny. Who knows if we'll get this opportunity again in the near future?" And because of the visionaries, we now have a state of Israel, which is very, very dynamic, which is flourishing, with all the difficulties that we have. And perhaps let me add, the spies were correct in saying that to be able to live in the land of Israel, You need to be a visionary. You need to be a person of stature. There are many difficulties on many levels. The grasshoppers are the ones who are overwhelmed by those difficulties, those pragmatic concerns. The visionaries are the ones who embrace the challenge and create realities. It's very unfortunate that when we read the story, the continuation of the story, in chapter 14, verse 1, it says, Vatisa kol ha'eda, that the congregation lifts up, vayitnu at kolam, and they now give their voice, vayivku ha'am balaylahu, and the people cry that night. And they complain in the next verse against Moshe, and they say, it would have been better to die in the land of Egypt or in the desert, and why have you brought us to basically be killed by the sword? Better that we should go back to Egypt. What seems to be is that at this moment of truth, the people raise their voice and make a decision. We're not ready to be men of stature. We're not ready to be visionaries. We want to go back to Egypt. There's a very interesting rabbinic comment which says, that night that they cried was in fact the night of Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. And God said, on that night you cried for no reason. Because of that, I will establish that night forever as a day of crying. And according to rabbinic tradition, Tisha B'Av is the day in which the first and second temples were destroyed, so that the Jews continue to cry on that night. And let me end with this point. For the Jewish people, Tisha B'Av signifies the opportunity to actualize their peoplehood, an opportunity which the Jewish people threw out. Had the Jewish people on the original night of Tisha B'Av rallied around Kalev and later Joshua, around Moses, around God, and said, yes, we realize the difficulties, but we're ready to now actualize our destiny, they would have entered the land of Israel and basically ushered in the Messianic era. And what we see throughout Jewish history is repetitions of this historic night. That over and over, the Jewish people are given opportunities to once again actualize their neighborhood, their nationhood. And they fail. They fail to be the visionaries. They fail to be the men of stature who can now become the people of God and create a model nation. And because of that, they forfeit the land. We too have been given this opportunity, once again, of creating a Jewish state, of actualizing our destiny. May we learn from the mistakes of the past and learn to be men of stature. Unfortunately, there have been too many grasshoppers who have brought us down. Now is the time for us to be able to rise and become those giants. To not ignore the difficulties, to recognize the difficulties, but to grapple with those difficulties. And in the words of Kalev, we can go up and we will surely triumph. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Please tell your friends about this podcast series. And please let us know your thoughts and comments. Send us email via podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks to Dr. David Bernstein, who is the executive producer of the Pardes from Jerusalem podcast series. Shalom and goodbye from Jerusalem.